Thank you very much. I like to preface any remarks I make about education by pointing out that I am not professionally prepared as an educator. What I have learned not simply by experience, but I suppose after experience. I'm not sure that we learn anything from the experience immediately. It is from reflecting on the experience afterwards that we learn something, and it has been my lot in life, as was pointed out to you a moment ago, to undergo a number of experiences in the management and operation of educational institutions. And from that experience, I have had occasion to reflect, and out of that reflection has come what little I know about education. I was trained as a political scientist, and as I'm sure most of you know, the professional preparation of people in political science and other academic disciplines prides itself in not preparing people to be educators. My position is not unlike that of a man who, and this is a very favorite story of mine, and if you've heard me speak before, you may have heard it, but that's all right. I think good stories are worth repeating, and so I repeat the few I can remember. But my position is not unlike that of the man who went to a farmer to buy a cow, and he asked the farmer what the cow's pedigree was, and the farmer said he didn't know anything about that. Well, he said, how much butterfat content was there in the milk? And the farmer said he didn't know. Well, how many pounds of milk did the cow give last year? Well, he said, I don't know, but she's an honest old cow, and she'll give you all the milk she's got. And I do stand before you today as an honest old cow, prepared to give you all the milk I've got, but I'm afraid that you should not restrict your diet in reflecting yourselves on education in the year 2000 to what limited milk you can secure from this experience which you have, I presume, voluntarily chosen to undergo. Or even rely too much on the reflections that you may have after the experience. I would stress that it is important in thinking about education in the year 2000 to expose yourselves to a wide variety of learning opportunities, because I think education is in a transitional period. It is in a state of ferment, and that it bears watching and observing and reading and thinking as we attempt to project ahead from where we are. My second caveat, in addition to the proposition that I am at best an honest old cow, is another favorite cliche of mine. And as you'll see, I think in clichés. It keeps me in touch with most of my contemporaries, and I, certainly in the education world. But a favorite cliché of mine is that in thinking ahead to the year 2000 or even to the year 1976, the best prognostication, the best prophecy, the best predicting that one can do is summarized by the statement that in education, as I suspect in the rest of life, the world will look more in the year 2000 like it does in 1975 than it looks differently. That is to say, I feel pretty strongly that things don't change nearly as much as we are prone to predict they will change when somebody asks us to predict what the world will be like 2,000 years from now. our imaginations take hold and we look at the marvelous technology and the great innovative ideas and creative thinkers having those ideas that surround us, and we project a future that's greatly different from the present. And I probably will indulge in a bit of that today, and I suspect you will, if you are wise, discount that, because the safest, and I think the most accurate prediction about the year 2000 is that it really is going to look an awful lot like the year 1975. Now, I suppose just to be absolutely safe in the best tradition of Germanic scholarship, which has taken over American education, to this I should add a footnote that if there is a cataclysmic event like some predict will happen in the way of war or a sudden outburst of peace, maybe there will indeed be radical changes. But my own feeling is that neither of those eventualities are something we can predict with any certainty, and that the probabilities are that things aren't going to change a heck of a lot in education. And in fact, if you reflect on the last couple of thousand years of Western education, at least, and I think that this is fairly general throughout the world, it's amazing how little has changed. 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago in Athens, people were doing pretty much what you and I are doing this afternoon, and they were calling it education. A cluster of them gathered around, and somebody started to talk, and they listened. And there's just, we haven't made many advances on that for most of our education. We've supplemented it. The first big supplement, of course, was when we discovered movable type and made books readily available. And of course, they were really a threat to the universities and schools of their time, and were kept out because it was felt that they would put the pendants out of work. And they didn't, of course. They gave them a new occupation, writing books for people not to read. But nonetheless, they were a threat in the beginning, and now they're rather central to the institution. More recently, in the last 25, 30, 50 years, we've discovered various kinds of electronic media, electric media, electronic media, wax media, film, and so on. And from time to time, we predict that these are going to replace what you and I are doing. And that's been said, I guess, since the first camera took the first picture and the first phonograph record made the first recording, that they were going to provide a new way of doing education. And I think that there are those who feel that by the year 2000, that new way will have arrived. My own suspicion is that that's not so. That even in the year 2000, there will be people sitting around listening to other live human beings do what you and I are doing this afternoon. Lest I be categorized as more conservative than I am, and I am very conservative by nature, as anyone who's at all familiar with my institution would tell you, I don't want to say that this prediction of minimal kinds of change is necessarily an advocacy of minimal kinds of change. I'm not arguing that what's been going on for the past 2,000 years, 2,500 years, or however, that is a group of people listening to somebody talk and calling it education, that it necessarily is education or that it necessarily is the best education. It simply is what we have come to expect in a teaching-learning situation. And my prediction is that an awful lot of education in the year 2000 will carry on in that tradition. And I think that there are some good pieces to that tradition, as I'll probably comment on in a little bit. All right, having having given you a long preface or a long footnote, for those of you who are taking notes, I want to guide you as we go along as to what it is you've just had, and that will not be covered on the exam. The questions they were referring to, I don't know whether they made it clear or not, are questions that I'm going to ask you at the end of the discussion, and then we're going to grade you on it, and I think that the university is giving 2 graduate credits for this course, I'm sure, if you pass the exam. Anyway, that's a long preface, and I want to go from that preface to talk a little bit about what I do think are some emerging characteristics which in my judgment stand a fair chance of being prominent, perhaps even dominant, in education in the next 25 years. First, let me talk about one of the existing characteristics which I think will be significantly modified. Education today, at every level, from preschool through graduate school, is largely characterized, to use a cliche again, to use some shorthand, by being white, male, and middle class. And one of the reasons that I think that there will be some changes in education by the year 2000 is that I think that that is no longer going to be acceptable by people who have enough power and influence to change things. I believe we need new forms of education, that it is not serving well many people who are not white, who are not male, and who are not middle class, who are racial and ethnic minorities, who are women, and who are economically poor and educationally poor. And it's my conviction that much of the ferment which has characterized the last 10 years in education has been generated by representatives of those who are not well served by white, male, middle class educational processes and institutions. They are pushing for change. They have had some small success, and it is small success, not large. And I think that they will have more success in the future, and will come, many of their aspirations will prevail in the next quarter century. There's not widespread agreement about what it is they are pushing toward. There is not a universal acceptance among those who advocate educational change of a set of characteristics which ought to prevail. But I think that I perceive some characteristics that can offer some significant change, and that these characteristics or these elements are ones which will serve well those not now well served by education, as well as produce educational institutions and processes which will serve better even those who are now satisfied, if not well served, by the existing systems. And I'm going to mention, in the time that's available this afternoon, three of these characteristics, which it seems to me are on the move, three of these three elements that are emerging in the current era, and which I think will come to have a very large role in the next 25 years, and I think be a major characteristics of education generally. First, I think the education of the future will recognize that education, learning, whatever we want to call it, belongs to the student and not to the educational institution collectively, nor to individual faculty members. This means to me that in the future, much more than in the present, decisions about the content of education, the substance, if you will, of education, and the strategies for learning will be made by the individual student. It is my conviction that we will see educational institutions operated on the principle that each individual student should have responsibility for and authority over his or her own education. Now, here's a good point for another footnote, perhaps. I don't think that this necessarily means or ought to mean that educational institutions will be operated by the students or controlled by the students collectively. In fact, I think that that is not a desirable step in the future of education. I don't think that we advance very far. In fact, I guess I would argue that we retrograde when we replace the collective judgment of the faculty with the collective judgment of the students about the content and strategies of other students' education. I don't think putting students on the curriculum committee, if you will, advances the cause of learning for other students. And in fact, I think that that kind of what I would call tokenism stands in the way of genuine educational change in the direction that I have just articulated. Because instead of recognizing that the education offered belongs to the student, and that therefore the student fundamentally must be taught early on how to accept that responsibility, instead of doing that, educational institutions are throwing responsibility for the management of the institution on the hands of people ill-equipped to manage large-scale institutions. And they're ducking out of the more fundamental question. And furthermore, I don't even think they're doing a service for the students who suddenly find themselves on the state university board, as they are in this state, or the curriculum committees, or other committees of the Board of Regents. Because I think we end up taking an awful lot of their time, which could better be given over to managing their own individual educations. But in any event, I don't think that increased participation by students in the governance, management, administration of educational institutions is the fundamental change which will occur in the next 25 years. I think the more fundamental change which will occur is the one which will recognize that education belongs to the individual student and its form and content should be determined by that student, and that educational institutions, instead of limiting the student's role in relation to his or her own education, will do all that they can to maximize it and to help students learn how to do that efficiently and effectively and with good results. And we'll begin that very early. We'll begin that very early. One of the paradoxes, it seems to me, of education in this country and in most other countries, but particularly in America, is that educational institutions here are charged with responsibility. They aren't the only ones who have this responsibility, but they have a major role, major responsibility, for preparing students to participate in a self-governing society. And they also have a major responsibility for preparing individuals to accept responsibility for their own lives. We all, I think, subscribe to the notion that the school should turn out responsible human beings who are good citizens and who run their lives well. And yet, within the educational institutions, we tend to minimize the role, the responsibility, the authority which the students in those institutions have over that portion of their lives for which those institutions are responsible. And the result is that students emerge from the American educational process, which absorbs such a central part of their lives from the time they're 3, 4, 5 years old until they're 18, 20, 22, 25, 6, 7 years old. They emerge from that process accustomed to relying upon the judgments of other people about that which matters most, and ill-prepared not only to make judgments, but to act on them, which is quite a different thing. They are given over to making judgments. I think that's a characteristic of young people anyway. But not prepared to act on them, and most especially not prepared to accept the consequences for making judgments and acting on them. And that, too, is a different order of responsibility. But our schools put authority figures in charge. From the time you enter kindergarten, there's always an authority figure present who knows best what's important about your life in that context, what you should learn, when you should learn it, how you should learn it, from whom you should learn it. The schools love to deal with all of those questions. What I think is that that by the year 2000, the schools may also become concerned about, do you know it? A second characteristic of the education of the future is that it will become what I call, because I have been prostituted by technology, and I suppose what I call, or lack of imagination, outcomes-oriented rather than input-oriented. And I do remember reading in Edwin Newman's delightful Speaking Frankly, why not talk about results instead of outcomes? And so maybe what I'm saying is that educational institutions will indeed become results-oriented and not concerned about not so concerned about the elements that are used to produce, supposedly produce those results. The present time, educational institutions and processes assume that they can control, that if they control the quality of such factors as the faculty and the facilities, that they can safely assume that there will be good educational results, even if those results are seldom specified in advance. I think that in the future, we'll see educational institutions which insist that their students define their educational goals and assist the students in doing that, putting a great deal of thought and attention on what one expects to learn and why, and then allowing the how, the faculty and the facilities, if you will, to fall into place behind the results or the outcome or the goals and objectives. Indeed, I think that it is very important that we stop focusing our attention on the questions of where did you learn it, or when did you learn it, or how did you learn it, or from whom did you learn it, all of which are input kinds of questions, and ask instead, do you know it, which is a results or outcome kind of question. And that leads to the third characteristic, which I think will prevail in the next 25 years. In contrast to the present, in which education is place-oriented and dominated by professional educators, I think that by the year 2000, the educational systems will rely very heavily on what I have come to call, along with a lot of other people, community-based learning resources. Such learning resources include physical facilities, events, and persons, which are not the property of, nor are they controlled by, an educational institution. At the present time, we do concentrate in the hands of our schools and colleges and universities most of the learning resources which most of the students use in order to acquire their education. Traditionally in this country, and for the most part around the world, educational institutions rely almost exclusively on professional educators employed as full-time faculty members to do the teaching, upon a centralized campus or school ground or school building, and upon events, classes, laboratory sessions, lectures, seminars, which are largely controlled by the institution. In my judgment, we'll see in the future educational processes which teach students, require students, to use all of the elements of their lives in their learning. The heavy emphasis upon place-centered education controlled by professionals has the result of separating education from life. In fact, some of our most eloquent rhetoric endorses that. We talk about a university education as a preparation for life. And we congratulate people at commencement, and the complete sentence is, you now are ready to commence living, whatever it was you were doing before. That's bad enough with young people, but it's especially bad for them after they stop being part of the educational system, because they are convinced that their education is done. It's finished. I am educated. That's bad enough with young people, but it's especially bad for them after they stop being part of the educational system, because they are convinced that their education is done. It's finished. I am educated. And so their mindset, our mindset, yours and mine, is one of not having to continue to learn as part of life. It's one of my other aphorisms, one of my cliches that I mentioned, that to live is to learn. And the corollary to that is that to stop learning is to die. In fact, I think the best definition, better than the one they're wrestling with out there in New Jersey about that poor girl in the hospital, a better definition is, has a person stopped learning? If they have, they're dead. Now, maybe we oughtn't to bury them physically, but they have literally buried themselves. And most people are just among the walking dead. No, I'm sorry. Many people are, not most people. I don't mean to make so broad a generalization. All of us at some time find ourselves among the walking dead. We turn off learning. And all too often, the time we do it is at the time of the last graduation from the last school process we're engaged in. The Gallup poll has shown for many years that the average college graduate in this country, during the year preceding the taking of the poll, has not read one book from cover to cover. Now, I'm not arguing that the only way you can get educated is by reading a book from cover to cover. But I am arguing that that ought not to be a characteristic of the average college graduate if our educational processes are indeed turning people on to learning as a central facet of living. Because I think it is useful, desirable, helpful, pertinent to read a book, occasionally. Well, even maybe as often as once a year. I wouldn't want it to become habit for me. And what I see in the future, by the year 2000, is a strong effort producing genuine results to break down this time and place and people monopoly of educational institutions as a way of getting people to see that wherever you are, whatever you're doing, even at 1:45 on a Wednesday afternoon or Thursday afternoon in a Mayo auditorium, it is possible to learn. Needlecraft and other kinds of things can be learned at that hour on a Thursday afternoon in the Mayo auditorium, whether you can learn anything about education or not. And the point is that educational institutions, educational processes, the educational system, instead of separating themselves from that, will reinforce it. How? There'll be a diminution of the role and status, I think, of the so-called professional educator, the teacher, the professor, the instructor, who is a full-time teacher, professor, instructor, and a much greater emphasis upon the role which all of us at some time or another play in teaching others something which we know. And that's another one of my aphorisms, that living is teaching by another name. Because so much of our time is given over as parents, as friends, as colleagues, as citizens, to sharing what we know with other people. And I see the educational system recognizing that kind of learning and to some extent capturing it, if you will, and incorporating it into the outcomes which educational institutions will be focusing on. We will identify and recruit knowledgeable people from throughout the community, much more than we do now. Those people are recruited, but not often by the formal educational systems. And more of the formal education of the society will be carried on by these people. So that finally, one's home, one's work, one's recreational activities, one's community service activities will all flow into one's learning. And at the same time, students will be taught to use the facilities and the resources of the community as learning resources. They will be taught not just how to use their particular school library, but how to utilize the community's libraries to achieve their learning goals. They'll be taught to use the mass media of communications effectively to achieve their educational results, rather than this heavy emphasis upon orienting a student to the university library or the high school library, and then assuming that the student can transfer that knowledge to the community, because we know they don't. They literally don't. Among the great underutilized resources of the community are its public libraries. But beyond that, so much of our educational system today is given over to recreating in a confined space the elements of the community which the educators think students ought to learn how to use. The theater, the music, the art, plus the other kinds of cognitive learning. I've picked up that word. I don't really know what it means, but it sounds good. And put it on a campus, and then assume that once you've mastered how to do it on the campus, you'll do it somewhere else. And it ain't necessarily so. In fact, we have a lot of evidence that it isn't so at all, that people do not transfer that time-controlled and place-centered learning to their lives after they leave the campus. Finally, I think that these characteristics that I have been talking about as something of the wave of the future will combine to produce, by the year 2000, the beginnings of a new definition of what it means to be learned. And that's perhaps the most spooky proposition of all to those of us who are professional educators. Traditionally, the so-called learned professions, law, medicine, theology, and education, have combined to define learning in terms of the knowledge associated with those professions, and more particularly, to define learning in terms not of the practice of those professions, but to define it in terms of what is taught in the schools of those professions. And as I suspect all of you know, there's quite a difference between the learning of a practicing lawyer and the learning of a practicing law professor. And that holds true across the board to a greater or lesser extent. What I see happening, however, is that by placing responsibility for and authority over education in the hands of the individual student, By emphasizing learning outcomes, learning results, rather than inputs, and by helping students to learn to rely upon community-based learning resources, we will, by the year 2000, have fairly thoroughly redefined what it means to be well-educated. We will be helping students conceive of a good education in relation to their needs and their aspirations, rather than having professional educators impose their values and aspirations on them. Will this be good or bad? Well, I'm not sure I can answer that question in a way that would satisfy you, but I suspect that the kinds of questions that you might want to look at, you might want to answer in relation to these characteristics, go something like this. Are the students who emerge from this educational system of the future able to direct their own education independent of institutions and processes controlled by others? Are they, in short, self-directed learners? Second, are they able to define their educational goals and to devise strategies for achieving these goals? Third, are they able to utilize the community and all of its resources for learning? Is learning a central part of their lives rather than something separate from living? I would say that if the answer to those questions is yes, that the educational system of the year 2000 will be significantly better than it is in the year 1975. I acknowledge that is the limited milk of an old cow coming out, and you may not agree. And it's my understanding that it is good pedagogical procedure, now that I have finished with my monopoly, to turn the meeting over to you for your questions and comments. I've been impressed by a marvelous essay from a man that I'm sure all of you respect, David Riesman, in a book that contains two essays, one by him and one by Seymour Martin Lipset. The book is entitled Politics and Education at Harvard. And the essay by David Riesman is a reflection on his experiences as an undergraduate, as a law student, and as a faculty member at Harvard in relation to the total history and ambiance of that institution. And since it's my privilege and responsibility to head an institution that doesn't have any history, I have profited vicariously from Harvard's history processed through the marvelous mind of David Riesman. And in that book, in that essay, he tells about his own teaching procedures. And I've seen him put this in practice when he came to lecture for us 2 or 3 years ago. He insists that he will never speak publicly without people asking questions and getting comments, because he wants to know whether they have the same understanding of what he said as he has. And so that's what this is all about, to find out whether you have the same understanding as I have of what I've been saying. Not that it's terribly important that you should do so, but I have a kind of intellectual curiosity about what it is you may have thought I said, just to see if it has any relationship to what I thought I said. Anyhow, all of that was a kind of extensive footnote while you thought about the questions you were going to ask.